to Mayo Clinic Educator Central, brought to you by the Learning Solutions Center at Mayo Clinic. I'm Stacey Kraft. From workplace training to higher education settings, team-based small group activities around problems are a staple. However, when we talk about the models of team-based learning versus problem-based learning, how these interact, differ, where they come from, as well as how to implement them meaningfully, sometimes we can get lost. So today we have Professor Dr. Diana Dolmans here to shed light on these complex topics, as well as help us navigate new spaces that re-envision how we use these terms and translate them into practice. Now, I couldn't be more excited to have Dr. Dolmans on the show. She is uniquely qualified to have this conversation. Dr. Dolmans is a professor in the field of innovative learning arrangements at Maastricht University, the Netherlands. Her research focuses on the key success factors of innovative curricula in higher education. She is internationally acknowledged for her line of research in problem-based learning. Since September 2016, she has been the scientific director of the Dutch Inter-University Center for Educational Sciences. She is department chair of the Educational Development and Research and a member of the management team of the research program Research in Education at the School of Health Professions Education of the Faculty of Health Medicine and Life Sciences, Maastricht University. She is also Associate Editor of Advances in Health Sciences Education, Editorial Board Member of several international journals, and has published in many revered international journals. So welcome, Dr. Dolmans. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, my name is Diana Dolmans. I'm a professor in the domain of educational sciences, and I'm working at Maastricht University, the Netherlands. My main domain of expertise is instructional design, and I have a special interest in small group learning in general and problem-based learning in specific.
Wonderful. Well, I wonder if you could start out today by helping everybody by defining maybe what team-based learning is and what problem-based learning is.
Let me start with problem-based learning because I have the most experience with problem-based learning. Problem-based learning has three key elements. And these are, first of all, the problem, second, the group learning, and third, the role of the facilitator. But let me explain it in a little more detail. So in PBL, we also always start with a problem. And a problem is a kind of a description of some phenomena that need to be explained. And usually these are problems or real life scenarios. And students are confronted with a description, for example, a description of a teacher who is developing a course and faces some problems to design the course. And typically what happens is that students start with discussing these kind of real authentic problems in small groups. So the second characteristic is the small group. Well, usually students work in, let's say, 6 to 10 students per group, and they start with discussing these problems. So they just wonder what they and tell each other what they already know about the problem. But while discussing this, they activate their prior knowledge, what they already know about the topic, but they also discover what they do not yet know. And these are issues that need some further self-study. So usually, after this first discussion in the group, students will leave the group discussion with a few issues that need further study. During the next, let's say, 2-3 days, students try to find more information about the issues they still need to know better. And then after 2-3 days, students come back and report and synthesize what they have learned and what they have read, and apply what they have read to the problem being discussed. And then the third element is the facilitator. So in PBL, usually each session is facilitated by a teacher. And this teacher usually has some expertise knowledge about the subject, but also has a lot of knowledge about how to facilitate a small group. So the three characteristics are a problem, group learning, and the facilitator or a teacher who is present. And then you ask me to explain team-based learning. Well, You know, team-based learning has a lot of similarities, but is also a little different. How does it usually look like? In team-based learning, students usually meet with an entire class of, let's say, maybe 20 students, and one teacher facilitates the class of 20 students. But before students meet with the teachers, they have to complete a so-called mandatory pre-reading assignment. And the idea is that they read before they meet actually in the classroom and prepare themselves. When they are in the classroom, typically the classroom starts with a so-called individual test in which students have to answer questions. But this is done individually, but also in small teams. So one teacher with 20 students splits up the group, the class, in smaller groups, and within these groups, students discuss some questions, answer a kind of quiz about their pre-reading assignment, and discuss with each other what are the right answers, tell the right answer to the teacher, and if there's some issues might be unclear, the teacher can help and answer. After this, you know, testing of this their pre-reading, there is a so-called group discussion again, but now about a real problem. So it's again a discussion, but then related to a problem in which is again being discussed in the small groups. So basically, when you take a look at team-based learning, it has many elements in common. Mm-hmm. We have small groups, we have problems which are being discussed, and we have a teacher. But there are also some differences. In PBL, usually every small group has one teacher. In team-based learning, it's much more efficient because one teacher can handle different small teams simultaneously. So that's one of the differences, I think, between the two. And that's hopefully an explanation about how team-based learning and problem-based learning look like in practice.
Yeah, so it seems like from what you've described, they both have a problem, but the problem in TBL has been moved to the end as sort of an end piece to what they've done, whereas in problem-based learning, it's the center. But, you know, why would we even use these strategies? What are the benefits of this? It takes a lot of work to set these up, so why would we go to such great lengths over traditional lecture?
Yes, I agree. It's not easy to, you know, design effective PBL setting and an effective classroom in team-based learning. But we do this because, you know, both team-based learning and problem-based learning are based on some underlying principles about learning, which we know are effective. And let me explain this a little. So what we know so far is about human learning is that learning is preferably organized around so-called complex or ill-defined problems. And it can be a problem, it can be called a task, it can be called a project, but a problem is derived from a kind of professionally relevant context. And the idea behind this is when you ask students to learn around and these problems, that you also stimulate them to apply what they learn and read to the problem. So the basic idea is that it's not, you know, a matter of telling the students this is what you need to know, but it's a matter of stimulating students to apply what they have learned to a real life problem. And that's why nowadays instructional designers argue when you develop a course, start from so-called problems. Mm-hmm. That's the first principle, that both in PBL and team-based learning play a role. And then there's another principle, and that's the notion nowadays that we think it's important to place the student at the center. So not the teacher, but the student. And this means that learning only takes place when students are encouraged to actively construct or reconstruct their models about the domain and their knowledge. So in PBL, we stimulate students to activate their prior knowledge. So it's just to know, aha, this is what I already know about the problem. And when they have to learn something new, we stimulate them to connect what they learn with what they already know. So it's important that, you know, we stimulate students to generate so-called meaningful relations between their prior knowledge and their new knowledge, that we stimulate students to ask questions, to self-explain themselves. And as you might know, you know, if you have to explain something in your own words, then you really need to understand the materials.
Mm-hmm.
So the second principle is, you know, make students active, constructive learners. And that's typically what we do in PBL and team-based learning.
And that seems to be similar to the concept of teach back in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's another principle that we know, you know, and that's about collaborative learning. So what we also know from research within the educational sciences is that students, when you stimulate them to learn from and with each other, that they more or less co-construct their knowledge. So it's important when we ask students to work in small groups, they collaborate, they can learn from each other and with each other, and so build better models about their knowledge. This is not to say that you always have students to make students work in small groups, but when you have to teach complex materials, which is what we usually do in higher education, it's crucial that students work in small groups and they can benefit and learn from each other and build upon each other. They can ask each other critical questions and so on. And that's again something that is done in PBL and TeamBL and team-based learning. We stimulate students to collaborate with each other and learn from and with each other. And then a fourth and final principle is that, you know, again goes back to placing the student at the center and not the teacher. And that is that we also know that we need to stimulate learners to take the lead in their own learning. So students should become so-called self-directed learners. They should themselves discover, what do I still need to learn? Which strategy might be effective to achieve my goal? And they should be able to evaluate their learning. And when you take a look at both PBL and team-based learning, we stimulate students also to generate, this is what I know already, this is something I don't know yet, and I need to study more in depth. And of course, one important warning here, this does not mean that we say, okay, a student should be a self-directed learner and we as teachers should not help them. No, it's crucial that we as teachers, you know, on the one hand, stimulate students to become self-directed learners.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, offer many scaffolds and support structures to help the students to become a self-directed learner. And this is what we do in PBL and team-based learning. So the teacher is present in some PBL sessions to help the students. In team-based learning, the teacher is there to help them. We have these kind of quizzes in team-based learning to help students to discover what they do know or don't know yet. So, you know, my basic message is, because you asked why are we doing these kind of student-centered, small-scale learning activities, that's because, you know, we know that we need to stimulate students to learn around complex problems, that we need to stimulate them to become actively involved in their own learning, to become a constructive learner, that we need to stimulate them third to learn from and with each other, collaborative learning, and fourth and finally, to become a self-directed learner. So I feel these principles are crucial. And that's why we don't do lecturing, but theme-based learning and problem-based learning.
You know, Dr. Dolmans, that makes a lot of sense. And to extrapolate a little bit farther, in some of your academic writing, you specifically mention medical education and medical students. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about why these collaborative education approaches are especially impactful to medical students.
Well, I'm not sure if it's especially helpful for medical students, but problem-based learning started about 50 years ago at McMaster in Canada and within a medical school.
Ah.
And one of the early adopters of this approach was also Maastricht University, where I'm working. Maastricht University is younger, also a little longer than 40 years now, still young, But we apply problem-based learning. We started with the medical school, with the health sciences, but we nowadays apply it in psychology, in business, in all different kinds of subjects. And it's not to say that you can copy-paste it from one curriculum to the other, but for sure it's also beneficial in other sciences and other subjects. So I wouldn't say that it's more helpful in the medical sciences. No, in all, training programs, in the end, we want students to become a kind of lifelong, professional, flexible learning. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it's crucial that we, you know, can do this in all kinds of different curricula.
So problem-based learning and team-based learning is applicable to just about any student body. It just sort of originated with a medical school setting. That's where it was created, and that may be why we see more talk in medical literature about problem-based learning, is there's a deeper history there. Exactly. Than yeah. with other programs. Interesting. So what I want to know next is, when we talk about, you know, you described what they were and the benefits very well of both of those. Well, one thing I want to know is, you know, we can't deny the fact that we're in a space with, where a lot of education is being put online virtually right now. And I feel like that inserts a specific challenge to the regular model of team-based learning and probably problem-based learning. Team-based learning is a blended format where people do stuff online beforehand, and they come in and they have that rich interaction in person, like right across from the table with each other. How does that translate online? Can it be translated to a virtual platform? Have you seen it done for both problem-based learning and team-based learning?
Well, yes, good question. Now, I've seen it for PBL, problem-based learning, and actually at Maastricht University, we are currently running our tutorial sessions online fully. What I've seen before is, for example, we developed a MOOC, a massive open online course on PBL, applying PBL. So both it was learning about PBL, but also we made some small groups work online and have a discussion and PBL sessions online. And yes, it works. But let me be honest, you know, what I see is that it also takes some extra challenges. Mm-hmm. And one of these, of course, is that, you know, in the beginning, especially, you have to handle all these technical issues around, you know, communicating online. You have to make clear appointments. You have to make sure how to mute and unmute, etc., and make it work technically. But I think these are all issues that, at least what I see, are quickly overcome. So we as teachers and students learned very quickly to adapt also now in this situation. But again, I think the biggest challenge is, again, how to apply the principles I explained online. And basically, the principles hold for online education and for face-to-face education. So it starts again with designing a very good, ill-designed problem. And yes, a tutor or teacher can facilitate the group discussion online. Maybe it might be a little less easy because, you know, you have to give some turns to students, etc., online. But you can do it as long as you develop a good case, a good problem to discuss. And I think that's the most important lesson to learn. We need to spend some more time in helping teachers to design ill-structured problems that, you know, work well to stimulate the discussion. We see nowadays teachers using these kind of, how do you call it, breakout rooms, or, you know, mm-hmm. you can split up the group in smaller groups. And then that's, I think, a nice example of a kind of mix of problem-based learning and team-based learning. Mm-hmm. So usually you see the tutor in PBL will start with, at least at Maastricht, with 10 students. And then on occasions they make these kind of small breakout rooms in which smaller groups of students can also discuss some issues and then bring it back to the group. But again, this small group discussion only works when you have good materials, good questions, that the students need to discuss and need to bring back to the full group when they enter again the full group discussion.
Right. I also think that with any online activity, making sure that you, as a teacher or a learner, stay engaged as a, have that personal connection with each other to stay engaged and have kind of digital best practices, which a lot of people necessarily aren't familiar with, which is what you talked about earlier, all the technical aspects, but there's the soft skills as well of just knowing how to connect with each other and communicate well over virtual.
I fully agree. And I must say that this is very, very important. The social presence, building a kind of social relationship online, is not easy, but it's something you also need to spend some time on. There are also some tools available. And this is crucial to motivate your students. You know, you need to find ways to get to know each other, to talk a little, to have some social talk. That's very, very, very crucial in face-to-face and online, and maybe even online even more.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, opening up the class and maybe having the first few minutes just be social time where people can come into the virtual space and just as they would like mill around and talk in real life, try to create that as much as you can in the virtual space.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of little tricks and tips for that, but that's just one of them that we use often. So,
yeah,
interesting. So
social coffee hours, or for example, what I did in one course is ask the students to introduce themselves. And I also, as a teacher, introduced myself, not only professionally, but for example, gave one example of a hobby that I liked and asked others to view these things before you meet. So these are things that are crucial.
Yeah, so like icebreakers, like we call them here. But I think those are really helpful as well. You know, I'm gonna take it off track for just a second. I'm curious, this, when we talk about problem-based learning, something that, and this could go all the way back to the definition, I suppose, with team-based learning, it seems like how you assess somebody, like teams is, I feel like the assessment aspect is built in there and it's easier to track. But how do you assess or grade, I'm using air quotes over here, how do you grade a learner's or student's performance in problem-based learning? What kind of assessment goes around that that would hit a grade book?
Oh, my goodness. Great question. But yes, it's crucial. Assessment should be aligned with the way you're teaching. So when you do assessment in PBL, it should be aligned with the principles behind PBL. But, you know, I think that would be another theme with a whole lecture. And I have some colleagues who could tell a lot about it. But typically, again, you know, it comes back to the principles I explained earlier. Like when you do a kind of testing, it's not only having a test in which you check how much knowledge they have, but also in which they work on assignments, in which they put these assignments in a portfolio, in which they give feedback, etc., on each other. So it should be a mix of different formats. So they call it nowadays a so-called programmatic assessment, in which you combine different things using portfolios.
Yeah.
Well, we have done these kind of, you know, tools in which students and teachers rate each other's performance and active participation in the group or gave peer feedback.
Sure.
And yes, it might be helpful. But in the end, I think you have to combine different formats and put it all together. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, it's important that you build a kind of structure in which students on a regular basis talk with each other about how are we performing, what's going well, what do we need to improve in the group. And having a talk about this in the group or a dialogue is, I think, crucial.
Well, and I think maybe shifting the perception, at least problem-based learning maybe isn't an assessment activity, it's a learning activity, and that you add a rich mix of assessments around that to assess how they're doing overall in your course, as opposed to just that learning exercise. I read your wonderful article that you and some co-authors wrote, Should We Choose Between Problem-Based Learning and Team-Based Learning? No, combine the best of both worlds. And I just loved it. And what I wanted to know is if you could tell me a little bit more about how these ideas might be combined or complementary, because they are so similar. And I often hear a struggle between where, you know, different educators are wondering which one they should choose. And so this article really struck me because of the idea, like, maybe you don't have to choose. Maybe there are compromises in the way or combinations.
No, I think, you know, you don't have to choose. You can combine different techniques as long as you, you know, stick to the principles I explained earlier. So let me give an example. In PBL, often we have a group of, let's say, 6 to 10 students, and we nowadays see that on occasions, the tutor splits up the group in 3 smaller teams within the group of 6 to 10. So maybe 2 or 3 teams within 1 tutorial session to work on a particular part or to discuss or have a dialogue about a particular issue, and then have, again, some dialogue within the bigger group of 10 students. What we also see is another example. In team-based learning, one teacher is teaching different small groups. This is something that we also try in PBL. In some faculties, for example, they also have so-called teacher-less groups. So the teacher is not available in every session. So maybe the tutor is available in one session, and in the next session, the students do the work on their own.
In a sample like that, would the groups maybe appoint a team leader or something to help keep them on?
Yes, in PBL, we always have a tutor. And besides that, one of the students should lead the discussion. So the tutor is only there to help if the student who is responsible for leading the discussion needs some help and support. So usually every meeting, another student is the leader. But, you know, this is something you can play with. And again, I think we should take a look at the student. And the more the student becomes more mature, you can also play with these roles and say, okay, students, you are a group. You want to learn something. I'm here for this session. And the next session, you can call me if you need. Or the next session, maybe you should already start and prepare. And then the session thereafter, I'm attending again. It's not to say, you know, that we should say, oh, students, it's up to you and find your own way. No, we should stimulate them to find ways to take their own lead in leading their learning. And that's something that, you know, we can play with.
So let's say that there are, you know, little groups doing the problem-based learning, and the instructor, the teacher, whatnot, is not available for every session, and it's available every so many sessions. In TBL, we see like all the groups come together at the end, right, and sort of interact with the faculty or the instructor. Do you see that happening with this blending of PBL, where people are working on the problem, but the groups connect, or do they stay isolated?
No, I see both. So usually what you also see is they start with a kind of team-based learning or problem-based learning in year one. And maybe in the later years, year three, for example, they work on a bigger project. And then, yes, they work in small groups. But then at a later stage, the different groups meet each other. They present each other, give each other feedback with, without teacher. So you can play with all these different techniques.
Mm-hmm. So not so rigid, because a lot of times when we talk about TBL and other formats like this, it's a very rigid format, like you must do this first and then you must do this next. So what you're proposing is that we loosen it up a bit, that it's not going to destroy the integrity of the learning, as long as our problems that we're basing it around and that all of the things that you mentioned about why it's important stay intact and why it's beneficial, then it will still continue to be beneficial.
You're right. I think, you know, nowadays, maybe indeed some people, when we tell this, might say, oh, Maastricht University is not using problem-based learning anymore because they're making some adaptations. But that's not true. For at Maastricht University, we said, you know, in the end, it's about the 4 principles I explained. And the techniques or the way we do it might be called PBL, might be called team-based learning, but they can differ. And, you know, the biggest challenge is always to find and to implement PBL, team-based learning, or whatever you call it, in your own context and adapt it to your own context. The proof of the pudding in the end is in the way it is implemented, if it's PBL or team-based learning. So it's always a matter of contextualizing, localizing. And you should ask yourself some questions when you implement PBL or team-based learning. For example, the question, you know, what about my staff members? What kind of experience or expertise do they have? And what are their ideas about teaching? And how many staff members are available? And based on this, you make your own adaptations. You also should wonder about your students. You know, we all have students who have different backgrounds, different experiences in working with small groups, etc. So take a look again at your students. If they do not have that much experience, you need perhaps to offer some more guidance in the beginning, and later on you can offer them less support. But always in the beginning, it's crucial to give a lot of support. And also, you know, take a look at your resources or your infrastructure. So what kind of rooms do you have available? Do you have small rooms for small group work? What kind of facilities do you have available online to arrange these kind of small group sessions? These are all questions you need to ask yourself before you actually are going to implement PBL or any student-centered approach to teaching.
And, you know, I was thinking about this terminology, PBL, TBL, and in some ways these are, I know they're, in some ways I think they can be like buzzwords, and that can make educators feel tethered to the rigid formats that they use. And that, you know, I really loved your four principles that you shared, because to me what that speaks to is that if educators take the time to understand the underlying principles behind why they're doing TBL, as opposed to just these are the steps I'm supposed to take to implement TBL, but don't really know why, why it's working. But if people can understand and really absorb and synthesize what those reasonings, those four principles, that naturally leads to us shedding these terms of PBL, TBL, and instead creating flexible, you know, adjusted models that work for the classroom or the group that you're particularly in charge of, with all of the items that you just mentioned, all of the caveats and variables that might fit your curriculum, your classroom, your abilities. And so I think that's really powerful. It's helpful to say PBL and it's helpful to say TBL to get people, you know, maybe thinking about what you're saying right away, like on board. It's a quick way to connect knowledge, but, you know, I think that there's a lot of rigid ideas around what that means. So I love coming back to those four principles. For educators who are new to this, how do they connect back to those principles and truly begin to understand and integrate them into their designs? How do we get them to understand the background and not just sort of cling to the model?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, one other important message is you have to spend a lot of time in teaching your faculty how to teach. And for example, in the Netherlands nowadays, all teachers working at the university, they need to have a so-called basic teaching qualification certificate. So they have to attend some courses on teaching. They have to, you know, gain some experience in real practice, upon which they reflect during the courses. They have to write a kind of teaching portfolio, and, you know, and we also stimulate them for continuing professional development. So we organize all kinds of activities to help them rethink their education, reflect on the way of teaching. And, you know, as I said in the beginning, at Maastricht University, we have problem-based learning now for more than 40 years, but we have been spending a lot of time on training our faculty members to be a good teacher and tutor. So before they actually are able to run a tutorial session, they have attended a course on problem-based learning, a course on tutoring. They have to have a... In the past, we started with telling them, you know, this is PBL, follow the steps, and this is what you have to do. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, and a few years ago, we change that towards telling them, these are the principles behind learning, what we know about learning so far. And this is how you can apply them in practice. But practice and give a feedback to you. We give you some feedback. But, you know, doing it in practice is challenging and not always easy. So it's hard work. It's not easy. But in the end, we stick to the principles, and we need to find ways on how to, you know, make these principles work in a given context. and that context differs, and the way in which PBL should look like differs as well.
When we look at PBL and TBL, or whatever we want to call it now, because I feel like we're shedding those terms, are there any drawbacks or negatives to that besides it's being difficult?
I think, you know, the major drawback is that it takes time to develop good PBL cases and problems, and or TBL problems. And, you know, we should spend some more time on helping our teachers and to design these problems, because if you have to design a good PBL problem or a team-based problem, you know, it needs to be one that's relevant for later professional practice, but it also needs to be one that sticks to particular objectives you want to achieve, that on the one hand stimulates students to become self-directed learners, that's preferably ill-structured, which means that, you know, it covers a topic from different disciplines. So when you design these problems, teachers from different disciplines have to collaborate a lot and think and rethink and, you know, work on designing these problems. So that's really something that takes time. And yes, some argue that especially PBL is very expensive because you have small groups and every small group has to be led by a teacher, which is true. But on the other hand, I think, you know, you have to find ways on, you know, how to stimulate your students. So you should not stick to one approach. Yeah, giving a lecture in which many students participate at once, which is a little interactive, might not be that effective as having these small groups. So maybe a little less hours scheduled for contact time, but the hours that you schedule are highly interactive and well designed than having many hours scheduled with lesser possibilities to interact and have a deep discussion.
Yeah, and when you mentioned, though, how we can combine or make these complementary, you know, one of the potential solutions was to maybe not have a teacher for every group every time. Yeah. So there may be ways to be creative about what limitations, like, you know, your classroom has and your institution has to make it work. Yeah. But it sounds to me like maybe what you're saying is that the drawback is that it has a higher investment in both resources and time, and that maybe in order to develop these sound problems that this is all being based around, that educators probably need to fundamentally understand the principles they're working with, yeah, to be available maybe more than they were planning on before. That, well, I mean, I would think they would probably need more support people, like perhaps instructional designers and other educational specialists to help maybe design that or work out the kinks. I'm kind of looking at that.
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, they need to collaborate with other teachers from other specialties, but also and disciplines, but also, you know, with educational scientists or other educational developers who help them. But in the end, if we want to have, you know, high quality education, I think, you know, you need to spend a lot of time in training your faculty members.
Do you have any tips? I know that, you know, these models are very kind of complex, so I'm not sure how easy tips would be. But if you have any easy tips for educators to take away that they can start applying today to at least get them on the right path towards maybe integrating something of this or understanding it better, what would that be?
Well, you know, my advice to individual teachers would be, you know, just give it a try. And, you know, what might work best in your context, I think, is a matter of, you know, giving it a try. It's a matter of reinventing it. It's a matter of finding your own way in your own situation. And you do that based on the principles I explained earlier, but also in close collaboration with other teachers, students, talk to them, ask for feedback. And I think that's one of the, have a dialogue with, you know, the people around you, with other teachers and students. And I think that's a good way to start from.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Dr. Dolmans. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be there. Thank you.
If If you have any ideas for topics, would like to be a guest, or want to reach out to us, send us an email at edufi@mayo.edu.